Okay, on the 11th anniversary of the U.S.-sponsored U.N. sanctions against Iraq, newly declassified documents show the U.S. government intentionally used sanctions against Iraq to degrade that country's water supply after the Gulf War. Thomas Nagy, author of the cover story, The Secret Behind the Sanctions, How the U.S. Intentionally Destroyed Iraq's Water Supply, that appears in September issue of Progressive magazine, cites seven partially declassified Pentagon documents dating back to 1991 to make his case. This morning, we're going to be talking with Rania Masri about the significance and implications of those documents. Lebanese by birth, Rania has been one of the leading opponents of America's sanctions policy and has tried to raise the awareness and the conscience of Americans about the devastation that the sanctions have brought to the Iraqi people. Welcome, Rania. Did you hear the introduction I made?
Yes, I did.
Okay, what are the implications and significance of this new report that the United States deliberately target the infrastructure, the water system, which is the basis of any society, as opposed to it being collateral damage?
Well, the implications are quite strong. First, let me state that this report was written by the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency back in January 1991, approximately 1 week after the bombardment of Iraq began. And this report states quite clearly that they knew what the consequences of the bombardment of Iraq's water treatment capacities would be. The report goes on further, and it even states that once these water treatment facilities are bombed, with 6 months of sanctions, they could be completely degraded. And they knew that no other solution exists except the rebuilding of the wastewater treatment facilities. Now, what is important to point out is not only did they deliberately bomb the wastewater treatment facilities in Iraq in 91, and know that 6 months would result in the degradation of the wastewater treatment facilities, but they have imposed sanctions for 11 years on the rebuilding of the wastewater treatment facilities, and not merely 6 months. And therefore, when we look at the UN reports and recognize that dirty water is the leading cause of child mortality, then this fact and these documents from the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency become all the more murderous.
Well, actually, and there's ample evidence in other countries throughout the world that contaminated water supplies leads to the high rates of child mortality. We don't even have to go south of the border to Mexico to see that.
Yeah.
In this situation, what way can this be brought to the American people? I mean, we have them wringing their hands in Washington saying this is all Saddam Hussein's fault. How can this be brought and raised before a Congress that is kind of wedded to a sanctions policy?
Well, first of all, we as Americans need to recognize exactly what the policy is. We need to understand that very well, and then we need to be working with the congressional representatives that oppose this policy. Now, what this is a policy that is built on two things, bombing and sanctions. They go hand in hand. And so in 1991, we had the deliberate bombardment of Iraq's civilian infrastructure in violation of the Geneva Convention, in violation of the rules of war, including our own rules of war, complete violation of that. The destruction of Iraq's civilian infrastructure therefore made Iraq all the weaker and all the more needing to have the sanctions lifted. But with the sanctions imposed, or reimposed, actually, Iraq was not allowed to rebuild this basic infrastructure, nor was it allowed to import very basic needs, such as agricultural supplies and food seeds. So consequently, we have had, as the UN has reported, more than 500,000 children under the age of 5 in Iraq killed because of these sanctions. That's more than 500,000 children. This is more than all the children that have been killed by both the atomic bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. So this is basically a silent nuclear bomb that is being dropped daily on Iraq as we speak. And no matter what we may think of the Iraqi regime, no matter how horrendous and how dictatorial the Iraqi regime is, destroying the country as a country and killing the people as a people only makes us equivalent to that regime. It puts us on the same level.
And this crime of destroying the water supply is something spelled out as a war crime in the Geneva Convention. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Definitely that is correct.
And two UN officials who were in charge of overseeing the food for oil, this kind of operation that makes people in America believe that actually the Iraqi people are getting served have resigned. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. Dennis Halliday, who was the assistant to the UN Secretary General and who served for 13 months as the first coordinator of the All for Food deal in Iraq, resigned. And his successor, Hans von Sponeck, also resigned. Both of these gentlemen resigned in protest to the sanctions and in protest to what they considered to be acts of genocide. Notice that we are no longer calling this acts of war crimes, but an act of genocide, wherein the destruction of the entire people as a people is the intention.
Getting back to the origins of the Iraq War, there are some observers, among them myself, who believe that the whole war was actually contrived in Washington to make use of kind of illusions on the part of Saddam Hussein that he, who had been a partner, in fact, had been armed by the U.S. for an attack on Iran following the Iranian Revolution, was actually our buddy, and that he had complained to the U.S. ambassador that prior to the invasion of Iraq, that Kuwait was doing slant drilling, that is, slant drilling into Iraqi oil supplies. Perhaps you could get into that a bit.
Yes, actually, before the invasion of Kuwait, Iraq sent three letters of protest to the United Nations in which it called the Kuwaiti actions acts of economic warfare. These are very, very strong terms, and unfortunately, there was no aspect of international diplomacy being mediated between Iraq and Kuwait at that time, which would have been the perfect time to stop any upending invasion or anything to come. It was back in 1990, in mid-1990. Now, what happened as a consequence was there were negotiations between Iraq and Kuwait, primarily to stop Iraq's slant drilling into Iraqi, to stop Kuwait's slant drilling into Iraqi territory, and to stop Kuwait from selling oil at a much lower price than was agreed upon by OPEC, which is extremely destructive for Iraq that was just coming out of a war. The negotiations halted very suddenly. Kuwait backtracked, and then we had the invasion of Kuwait by the Iraqi forces. Before the invasion, the Iraqi president met with U.S. Ambassador April Gillespie at that time and basically told her what was going to happen and asked her if the U.S. would interfere in border disputes between Iraq and Kuwait, and she responded that this was an Arab problem. So one could look at all that and could say Iraq fell into a trap or Iraq was being very naive. However, one can also step beyond and recognize that there was a Carter Doctrine that stated that Gulf interests are U.S. interests, basically that no country in the world has the right to control their own resources because we as Americans have the right to control everyone's resources. It's blatant hegemony and blatant imperialism to the full front. It's quite unfortunate that we had this invasion, and it has been even more destructive that we've had 11 years of war against the 22 million completely innocent people of Iraq.
Now, given that these documents have come out and reveal what the ultimate goal was to destroy what was probably a country with the highest standard of living in the Middle East,
or
at least close to that of Israel for many of the Iraqis, was and is, do you believe, the United States' goal is to get rid of Saddam Hussein or to maintain him in power?
I don't really know, and I think with this it would simply become an either-or. Perhaps the United States does want to keep Saddam Hussein in power because so long as he is in power, the United States has a boogeyman to continue to sell weapons of mass destruction. In other words, right now the military-industrial complex is making approximately $40 billion a year in the sale of weapons to the Arab countries, primarily the Arab Gulf countries, and of course the sale of weapons to Israel. And the creation of a monster in the persona of Saddam Hussein greatly helps in the sale of these weapons. Furthermore, so long as there is this creation of a monster, the American military bases can continue to remain on Arab soil, specifically in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, and they can continue to grow. So perhaps there is there is legitimacy in that. However, one can also look at the other side and say perhaps it would also be beneficial to remove the Iraqi dictator and have him replaced by another dictator. Now, we have to keep in mind that a democratic Iraq is not what the U.S. administration wants. The U.S. administration has stated that it wants a military coup, basically another dictator, very similar to how the U.S. led the coup against democratically elected President Salvador Allende in Chile and had him replaced by a dictatorial General Pinochet, regardless of the human rights violations that Pinochet conducted. So in that sense, perhaps they do want another dictator in Iraq who would open up Iraqi oil reserves to American companies and open up Iraqi resources to American companies. So there is benefit either way for the economic elite in the United States. But for the average American, the average middle class, the average lower income class American, either policy is extremely destructive to us, I would say, primarily because maintaining this policy on Iraq, maintaining this level of, quote, containment and this 11 years of war is costing American taxpayers a great deal of money. It is increasing American resentment against Americans overseas, and it is also shifting the discourse in the United States away from the issues that it should be, away from issues of immediate social welfare and immediate needs for Americans here in the U.S. So in a way, this policy serves a double-edged sword. It kills Iraqis. At the same time, it kills lower-income Americans, all the while benefiting the economic elite in this country.
Because, of course, they keep building up and building up a military budget that's now over $310 billion and threatening to rise. And obviously, having a bogeyman like Saddam is used, as in the past, I believe, we used Gaddafi.
Yes.
And we used Khomeini in Iran. We need, I guess, an enemy figure to divert the American public's attention from what needs to be done here at home.
Exactly.
There's a lot of confusion circulated in the mainstream media about the recent effort of the United States to modify the sanctions. Perhaps you can go into that.
Yes. Well, the so-called smart sanctions is a very powerful public relations ploy that the United States and the United Kingdom have been playing, presenting them as an alleviation of the humanitarian consequences of the sanctions. And they're a complete farce. And I say they're a complete farce because by looking at them in detail, we recognize that first and foremost, these so-called smart sanctions speak of the permanence of sanctions on the people of Iraq. There is no talk of when they would be removed, nor any talk of what the Iraqi government would need to do in order to lift this imprisonment of their people. So again, this is a permanence of this policy. In addition, smart sanctions actually strengthen the sanctions regime and not weaken it in any way. The borders around Iraq will be intensified, will be militarized by the United States, and therefore the Iraqi people will lose the little bit of cash that they are allowed in via these porous borders, which will be destructive to them. The third point is with regards to the hold. Now, currently, the United States has a great deal of items on hold. Let me explain this briefly. The oil for food deal allows Iraq to sell a portion of its oil resources up to a certain amount of money. All this money is held in a UN escrow account, all of it. Only 66% of it is then allocated back to the Iraqi people. Now, from the 66%, the Iraqi government has to apply for contracts. It has to apply, let's say, for rice or for insulin or for pencils. And the Security Council, or the 661 Committee of the Security Council, has to approve these contracts each and every time. And the United States has a great deal of these contracts on hold. Now, these smart sanctions talk about lifting the hold policy, but what that really means is that instead of the United States placing them on hold, they would flat out reject them. And we have to recognize also that this oil for food deal, which is talked about as being a humanitarian savior, is also a very powerful public relations ploy. The oil for food deal, Iraq has sold approximately $40 billion worth of oil since 1996, which for a country of 22 million people is a very small amount. But nevertheless, from these $40 billion worth of oil, only $12 billion has actually been allocated back to the Iraqi people. In other words, they have only seen $12 billion of the $40 billion that they themselves have sold. And this is the oil for food deal. And the smart sanctions will only make the problem even worse.
Now, I referred earlier to the standard of living in Iraq before the Gulf War. Perhaps you could comment on that and what these sanctions have done to that.
Yes. Well, let me tell you what a UN report published in 1999 speaks of this. And I am quoting here. This UN report states, Iraq has experienced a shift from relative affluence to massive poverty, in marked contrast to the prevailing situation prior to the events of 1990, The infant mortality rates in Iraq today are among the highest in the world. Low infant birth weight affects at least 23% of all births. Chronic malnutrition affects every fourth child under 5 years of age. Only 41% of the population have regular access to clean water. 83% of all schools need substantial repairs. The Iraqi healthcare system today is in a decrepit state, and it would take $7 billion U.S. dollars to rehabilitate the power sector community worldwide, I mean, in the whole country. So it basically paints a picture of a complete devastation of a country from first world economic status back to the Stone Age, basically, where clean water has become a luxury, where the majority of children suffer from extreme malnutrition. Now, when we are talking about chronic malnutrition, that means that these children will become retarded, either physically, mentally, or emotionally. This is medically speaking. And every fourth child in Iraq is chronically malnourished. So imagine what this will do to this generation, what this will do to Iraq in the future.
And, of course, hardly any of this information gets into the mainstream media. Even another aspect is the U.S. and British bombing of so-called no-fly zones, which is not sanctioned by the United Nations. But I noticed, like, last week, even though no British or American plane has been hit by any Iraqi missile, even the locking on of radar is enough justification for so-called, for the U.S. or the British, let's call it mainly the U.S., to do the attacking. And the illusion that has been presented to the American people, even repeated on Berkeley Station KPFA News the other day, that these no-fly zones were there to protect the Kurds in the north and the Shia in the south. Do you accept that reasoning?
No, not at all. Not at all. These no-fly zones are a U.S. unilateral objective. They are not U.N. sanctioned. Actually, both U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan and U.N. Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali before Kofi Annan have stated quite clearly that there is no U.N. Security Council resolution that gives approval for these no-fly zones, nor are these no-fly zones sanctioned by the U.N. Charter. So they are a violation of law. These no-fly zones are a violation of...
Hello?
Hello, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what just happened there.
Yeah.
So they're illegal. Of that, the bombings that occur by the U.S. and by the U.K. actually kill Kurds and Shiites as well as other Iraqis. So this element of we are protecting you while we are killing you either, you know, also talks of further ludicrousy. The third point is that Iraq has the legitimate right to defend its airspace. Legally speaking, it has the legitimate right to defend its airspace and therefore even the legitimate right to down any of these planes that violate its airspace. So it is actually the U.S. and the U.K. that are the aggressor here, completely in every shape of the word. And we need to recognize that as it is. And I have to say, I think that one of the main reasons that the mainstream media does not speak about the consequences of the bombing or the consequences of the continuing sanctions is because that they are Iraqis who are dying. They are Arabs who are dying. And the death of Arabs, as are the deaths of any minority in this country, are considered not newsworthy. It is not considered news when Arabs die. There is such an element of racism inherent in this policy that it is sickening.
Well, it's interesting that the United States is very willing for the Turkish government to kill the Kurdish people of Turkey.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And for the Israelis to bomb when they bomb in Lebanon, invade in Lebanon,
yes,
to kill the Shia of southern Lebanon. So these contradictions, I know, are never pointed up in the mainstream media. One little piece of history, which most people have forgotten here, if they remembered it at all, was the incident that pushed Congress and the Senate to vote for going to war against Iraq. Was an incident in which a young Kuwaiti woman appeared in a caucus in Congress announcing she had come from Kuwait and that she had witnessed with her own eyes Iraqi soldiers throwing about 100 babies out of incubators to take these incubators back to Kuwait. That was arranged by a congressman from San Francisco, Tom Lantos, in cooperation with the Hill & Knowlton Public Relations Company. And it turned out that that young woman had not come from Kuwait, but was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador. Is that story still circulating, or is that pretty much forgotten?
That story, unfortunately, has been pretty much forgotten, as have numerous other stories that erupted in 1991 and since. It seems that stories that remind us that we are not living in a community in which free speech is rampant, in which we get the true essence of the information, are stories that we try to forget as Americans, and they are stories that we must remember, especially when the representatives and the senators are still in office. Tom Lantos committed a crime. He knowingly utilized a witness that he knew was speaking lies, that was speaking falsities, at a time when it was critical for foreign policy, critical for Americans, and critical for Iraqis. And he employed deceit in order to get a vote. And it is shameful that the man is still in office.
By the way, Tom Lantos, on September 9th in San Francisco, will be receiving the Jewish National Fund's Tree of Life Award for his humanitarian efforts, among which is calling for sanctions, pushing legislation for sanctions against the Palestinians, as well as continuing sanctions against Iraq. And in this situation, and I'm going to go to the phones about 7 minutes, but in this situation, perhaps you could make the connection between what is happening to Iraq and what's happening now in the crisis between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Yes, in both instances, we have a complete shift of the truth, where war is peace and slavery is freedom. In Palestine right now, we have the Israelis themselves presented as the victims and the Palestinians presented as the aggressors. What we need to understand is this. The Palestinians are fighting against an illegal military occupation that has been persistent for more than 34 years. An illegal military occupation. The Israelis have absolutely no legitimate right to be in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, or in Gaza. Their presence there as soldiers or as settlers is in violation of international law and in violation of UN Security Council resolutions. The Palestinians are trying to liberate their land, something that we as Americans must stand with them, working with them for liberation and for sovereignty. The Israeli government, on the other hand, is trying to expand its borders, trying to increase its military occupation, and continuing to commit assassinations, executions, and mass tortures against Palestinians, as well as bombardments and complete closures of Palestinian territory, including closures of Palestinian bank accounts. This is abhorrent, and to think that we in America are actually supporting the occupier instead of supporting the people trying to be liberated is, again, a shame against our American consciousness.
Why do you think, both in the situation of Iraq and also in the case of the struggle over the Palestinian effort to rid itself of Israeli occupation, that there's virtually no American opposition, and we're paying an estimated between $12 and $15 million a day to Israel to support that occupation, paying for the jets, paying for the helicopters, and yet back in Central America's struggle, when Congress was debating $15 million a year for the Nicaraguan Contras, you had a mass mobilization of activists to stop $15 million a year, but we see nothing to stop $3 or $4 or $5 billion a day to Israel. How do you account for that?
I think there are a number of reasons for that. The military-industrial complex in this country is very, very strong, and it benefits from the continued war both against Iraq and against the people of Palestine. Furthermore, we also have a very strong pro-Israeli lobby in this country, which maintains its seats on Congress, maintains, for example, its support of Tom Lantos and other people who are definitely not human rights activists, but actually advocates for a very partisan cause. The third point is, and it's a quite unfortunate point, is that the majority of the foreign news in this country are controlled by a very small amount of people. The majority of the newspapers across the country depend their foreign news on the New York Times, for example. And the New York Times foreign correspondents have their own agenda. The last thing they do is tell us the full story. So then we have the complete dissemination of false information or of misinformation, which we as Americans accept, and therefore we go along with this policy and don't raise the roof on this injustice that we are actually paying for.
A settlement in the West Bank is just referred to as being in the West Bank and not either occupied or disputed. We have the assassination being used, in fact, in the Israeli press to describe what they're doing, but now being called targeted killings in the Western media. And then we have three Israeli soldiers captured by Hezbollah forces in southern Lebanon, and suddenly they're abducted and or kidnapped as if they were children or civilians.
That's
and when
right.
armed soldiers are on active duty, they're never kidnapped. But this control of the language is something that undermines consciousness. But again, we have people who are progressive. We have people going around the world protesting in this country and in Europe against the globalization forces of the WTO, the IMF, the World Bank, but yet none of these people seem to be concerned about what's going on either in Iraq or with the Palestinian-Israeli struggle. And
yes,
that's a thing, that's something that troubles me. Perhaps you have some ideas about that.
Well, I think that we as peace activists need to remind all other activists of the commonality of our struggle. Working for the liberation of Palestine, working for the liberation of Iraqis from the sanctions is the same issue as working for the liberation of the Puerto Ricans from the Navy bombing of Vieques, as working for the liberation of Chiapas, as working for the liberation of any people anywhere against any form of oppression. Really, oppression is the same, and the oppressors are the same. And we, as victims of this oppression, need to recognize that and need to continually link our arms together and not allow false information or prejudice or any form of racism to get in between us, because I firmly believe that our struggles worldwide can only be achieved once we as individuals and as activists link our arms together worldwide, once we have a globalization of activists working to fight the globalization of the oppressor.
And of course, you see the link between what's going on with the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the sanctions in Iraq as part of that anti-globalization effort.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Very much so. Very much so. And I want to add one thing. When you were talking about the mainstream media, the Washington Post recently published an editorial that was absolutely despicable. And I have to say, even for the Post, it was one of the most despicable articles they have ever published. In this article, Michael Kelly claimed that the Intifada had been taking place in Israel rather than in territories under Israeli military occupation. He also claimed that the Palestinians are the aggressor and not Israel's massive army of invasion, conquest, and occupation. And instead of urging Israel to comply with UN resolutions and comply with international law, Kelly actually urged Israel to, quote, go right ahead and escalate the violence and destroy, kill, capture, and expel the Palestinian forces. Now, if this had been written about any other people, it would have been labeled as racist and as inciting violence. But yet when it is talked about regarding the Palestinians, it is accepted as news. And we must be more ready and more savvy consumers of news than we currently are.
Well, a month ago, the chief rabbi of the Mizrahim, or the Middle Eastern Jews, improperly called Sephardim, made a statement that the Arabs should be annihilated without exception, and he was joined with qualifications by the chief rabbi for the Ashkenazi, Meir Lau, who said that the Israeli assassination policy is a commandment of God. We are speaking with Rania Masri. She's on the phone from North Carolina about the situation in Iraq, and we do have a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, North Carolina is the very best place. Tar Heels.
Thank you.
I have a question about Kuwait, which has a local twist. This radio station rose to the occasion of the turkey shoot in the desert really well. And one of the things that happened, if you remember, is that George Bush went on TV and newspapers saying with a straight face the Hill and Knowlton story that premature babies in Kuwait were stacked, quote, stacked like cordwood. And because I actually had a premature baby, I thought, well, Kuwait, everybody is well comfortable, and it's very unlikely that such a small place would have enough premature babies to stack like cordwood. And one of the people taken in by the story was Amnesty International at the top. And when after the Gulf War, and Ed Coas on KMFB was just bad on the babies, we couldn't stop him. And after the war, I mentioned on the radio on some public comment show that Amnesty International had been taken in by this obviously ludicrous story. And I've been on the condemned list of the Mendocino chapter of Amnesty International ever since I said that. And so I would appreciate if you would comment on that, and also what the structure of Kuwait is, and why, if it's the 51st state, we can't enjoy the same benefits for the poor in this country that there are none of in Kuwait, if I understand correctly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, well, let me say that I am still waiting for an apology from Amnesty International for their dissemination of that very false report, and also for their dissemination of that report at a time when they should have known that that report would have added to the fever for war. And Amnesty International, of all organizations, should be against the fever for war, regardless who was the aggressor and who was the victim. We as activists should be opposed to violence in the form of warfare at all times. And so I am still very much waiting for that apology from Amnesty International. Honestly, I don't think we're going to get it. But at the same time, I think we should be moving with Amnesty International to have them recognize that sanctions are an act of warfare, that currently sanctions against the Iraqi people are an act of genocide, in which all 22 million people of Iraq are basically being held as political prisoners by the U.S. government and by the U.N. Security Council. And therefore, this does fall in line with Amnesty International's charter of being opposed to political prisoners, to the taking of people as political prisoners. And I urge all AI members to contact their AI chapter and to get them moving on this, because the credibility of AI rests on this issue, as well as it rests on their apology that has yet to be achieved. With regards to the baby story, it is quite odd how they fabricated a story with regards to Kuwaiti babies, and they have not been telling the American public about the Iraqi babies who are dying from malnutrition, who do not even have incubators, who are being born at a very premature rate, and whose mothers are suffering very high rates of miscarriages, whose mothers are so malnourished that they cannot even breastfeed their babies because they do not even have the milk within them to give to their babies. And we are not told of those, as if Iraqi babies' lives are not worthy at all. With regards to Kuwait, Kuwait, like all other Arab regimes, like all other especially Arab Gulf regimes, is a dictatorship. It is ruled by one family. And the majority of the people in Kuwait are not Kuwaitis. The majority of the people in Kuwait do not have Kuwaiti citizenship. So if you are a Kuwaiti who is attached in one way or another with the Kuwaiti ruling family, you will be treated fine. However, if you are one of the other people of Kuwait, one of the vast majority of the people living in Kuwait, then you do not have any rights under that government. You do not have the right to vote under this farce of democracy, nor do you get any of the other really specific elements of social welfare in Kuwait. Now, especially as Americans, it is devastating for us as Americans that while we watch our loans to education decrease, while we watch our schools get into worse and worse conditions, while we watch our children as young as 14 being sentenced as adults and the juvenile prison industrial complex only growing in strength, we do not hear the discussion of this issue, and we see our taxpayer money and our policies going to kill babies overseas instead of even taking care of our own children right here. And we need to recognize how these issues are all linked, how the oppression of the American public is also linked to the oppression of the Iraqi public. And we need to stand together on this issue.
Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. I can't really speak about Iraq, but I was in Israel, and I was probably about 40 kilometers south of Ramallah, and then into Jerusalem, and south of that, working on an oil pipeline. And I saw the most amazing thing. I heard this big bang and this big cloud of smoke, and I figured, oh, gosh, something in the oil or something. And I started towards it. It was about a half a mile away, and when I got there, it was a school bus full of 10-year-olds about, and they had been machine-gunned and firebombed with Molotov cocktails. And there was this Palestinian guy who was very, very dead on the scene. The citizens of the area, the Jewish people, just shot him. Now, I realize it was a terrible thing to do. He should have been tried under an international court. But, you know, quite frankly, I think the Israelis have behaved with admirable restraint in this kind of a nature. can't imagine how anybody can ignore the terrorist attacks put on the Jews, and they didn't repay in kind to the Palestinians. They're killing a few. They're assassinating the political infrastructure of Hezbollah.
Do you have a question?
Why the hell would you talk about that kind of thing?
Okay, Rania?
I'd very much like to comment to that. I agree with you that the Israeli government has not been responding in kind to what the Palestinian people are doing. They have been responding at least 100 times over. Now, you tell me, sir, when Palestinian children are fighting with stones, and when the Palestinians are fighting with very old Russian Kalashnikovs, and if anybody knows a Russian Kalashnikov, you know that it is no match to any American-made weapon, when at the most that a Palestinian man who has been twice made a refugee, who has been kicked out of his home in 1948 and again made a refugee, again had all his rights taken from him, has lost all hope, and the last thing that he can do is become a suicide bomber. And you have the Israeli government responding with Apache helicopters, F-16s, with bombs that weigh more than a ton, with a complete closure on the Palestinian people, with massive machine gun fired at nonviolent civil demonstrators within Palestine, while they continue their illegal 34-year-old military occupation of an innocent people who are struggling for survival. And you dare talk to me about restraint? We have had more than 600 Palestinians killed, 60% of whom are children. We have had Palestinian leaders assassinated in violation of international law. We have had Israeli tanks paid for by U.S. weaponry march into Palestinian refugee camps time and time again, bombing Palestinian neighborhoods time and time again, killing civilians, killing infants as young as 4 months of age. And you talk to me about restraint? What the hell are those Jewish settlers doing illegally occupying Palestinian land to begin with? Sir, please do not talk to me about restraint. If all countries in the world act with the restraint that the Israeli government is acting against the Palestinian population, then we would have seen massive outbreaks of war worldwide. What is unbelievable is that when the death of one Israeli is spoken about, it marches across the entire media. But when we have 5 Palestinian children killed daily, every single day, by Israeli soldiers who are armed to the teeth with U.S. weapons, somehow that does not make the media. Every child in this world deserves to live free and with their rights. But in the state of Israel, you only have your rights if you are a Jew. And if you are not a Jew, you do not have your rights. The laws are different. They govern where you drive. They govern what cars you use. They govern how you vote. They govern how you live, they govern your house, they govern whether you can rent or own. And if you are a Palestinian in the occupied lands, they even govern whether you can plant on your own land, whether you have the right to open an office, whether you can build your own house on land that you own. We have seen an increase of home demolitions in the Palestinian territories conducted by the Israeli government. If restraint is that only 600 to 700 Palestinians are being killed, then I am terrified at what you would consider equality or not restraint. Let us please, I beg of all your listeners, to regard Palestinians as we as Americans would like to be regarded, and not to regard them as somehow people who happen to be living on this land. Palestinians have been living on the land of Palestine for more than 2,000 years, and what they are asking for is their own legitimate right to live as free people on their land. They are asking for the implementation of international law. They are asking for the end of military occupation. 34 years of Israeli military occupation governing every aspect of Palestinian life. And we are asking them to be quiet, instead of we as Americans should be asking them for their independence, as we as Americans have struggled for our independence. And we should not be utilizing double standards. We as Americans should be asking for the destruction of the apartheid system in Israel, as we as Americans ask for the destruction of the apartheid system in South Africa. It should not matter if you are a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim or a Buddhist or an atheist. You should have the right to live with your head upheld high. You should have the same civil rights. But in the state of Israel, if you are a Jew, you have the right to torture and kill a Palestinian. It is legal to torture Palestinians in the state of Israel. How can we as Americans continue to support such a policy?
Well said, Rania. I will just say in Denmark, they refused to accept Israel's selection as ambassador because he was former head of Shin Bet, where he carried out and defended the policy of moderate pressure torture defined by the Geneva Conventions. Israel is the only country that legalizes torture. Of course, torture is carried out throughout the world. I should say the Middle East Children's Alliance is going to have on its website very soon a history of massacres of Palestinians by then Palestinian, by Jews in Palestine from 1939 to 1948, research done by a scholar at the University of California. I've seen this list. It's extraordinary. It's a history we know is written by winners, but now the losers are those who have lost thus far are going to have an opportunity at least get the information out. It is not as it appears to be in the American media. Well, I'm going to take one more call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I really want to thank you guys for putting on this program. I think the caller really responded to the last caller really well. And maybe she could try to tell us what we could do about getting the information out to our community, because basically, as you can see, that people really don't know what's going on here, and mainly because of NPR has the lock on our station. And if she could respond to the media problem we have in our local area with regards to this international problem.
Yeah, very quick, Ronnie, because we're running into the end of the hour.
First of all, I'd say that we have to get ourselves informed. And in addition to the Mecca website, I urge people to check this following website, which is electronicintifada.net. That's one word, electronicintifada.net. Once we are informed, then we must continue to press the doors of the mainstream media, especially the local media. Meet with the editorial staff. Write those letters to the editor. Meet with those reporters. Ask them to change their policy. At the same time, we must continue to disseminate this information amongst ourselves, among civic communities, and among human rights communities, and within other communities that they themselves are oppressed. We have to be working together on that front. I do want to make one final note that I urge everybody to support a bill currently in Congress. It's the H.R. 742 bill. It's the Humanitarian Exports Leading to Peace Act of 2001. This was introduced by Representative John Conyers of Michigan. This bill is the strongest anti-sanctions bill that has yet been introduced in Congress. And I urge everyone to call your representative to ask them to support it. The congressional switchboard number is 202-225-3121, and the bill is H.R. 742.
Okay, thank you very much, Rania. Ron Masri, we've been speaking with about the situation in Iraq and later in Palestine.